Okay, good morning. We're going to begin just for the sake of timeliness. And hopefully the rally's sounds won't be picked up too much by our sound system. We're up to the third shiur today, dealing with philosophy, Kabbalah, and religious experience. And this is another part of the heart. There are so many aspects of the heart of Judaism, which is what this eight-part course is about. But after dealing with the tenets of faith and how to deal with people who either doubt or aren't really sure, or just have a different interpretation of Judaism, that's what we've dealt with in the first couple of weeks. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're now up to what it takes to develop a religious worldview and some of the most important trends in the last couple thousand years. It all starts off with the good old days where the Torah makes it perfectly clear that our covenant with God, the covenant between God and Israel, is the Torah. The Torah is our constitution in every sense. And that includes a relationship with God, that includes keeping all the laws. That is the basic tenet of the constitution of the Jewish people. And it always has been, always will be. These are eternal principles, and we spent some time talking about that. What happened in the medieval period for the very first time is a desire to systematize Jewish thought. That never happened before the medieval period. Last time we spoke only about beliefs, but actually it happened in every arena. If you open up the Torah, what is in the Torah? What are the contents of the Torah? Just give me some examples. What do you find in the Torah?
Laws.
You find laws. You find stories. What else?
Contradictions.
Find contradictions. That's true also.
Threats.
We find threats. We find covenantal language. We find things about the relationship with God. We find things about character development. Everything you could think of, and it's all just kind of mushed together. Right? The Torah doesn't have, okay, here's the legal part, and here's the narrative part, and there's no relation. They're not disciplines in the Torah. The Torah is the Torah. You open up the Talmud, you get the same thing. Pages jump in between this and that and the other thing. Often statements are lumped together just because of the same person said five things in a row. So it was an easy way to remember them back in the days before the Talmuds were written up. And so law, belief, character development, science, philosophy, you name it, character development, all these different categories that we might have as disciplines. There was no such thing as disciplines. This was simply Torah. In the medieval period, for the first time, you start getting systematized codes. Rambam wrote the first official legal code of halakha. Everybody cared about what the law was before Rambam. Rambam was the first one to say, why don't I just organize the entire Talmud into topical categories? It's one of the most brilliant things ever done in the history of Judaism. But he invented the idea of a code. Nobody had done that before.
There's a lot. Nobody had done it that actually they held on to it.
They held on to it, but I don't think anybody even tried it before. That's simply not the way, in other words, in the olden days, what happened? If you wanted to know what is the law, so you would ask your rabbi, and if that rabbi didn't know, he would write to the great rabbis of the world, and your answer, back before the email, that could take months, right? But at least people knew who to turn to. There were leading giants of the Talmudic academies, primarily in Babylonia, which is now Iraq, and also somewhat in Israel. And people understood if you had really serious, hard questions, you wrote to the greatest ones, and they would be able to answer that. But nobody wrote a code that everybody can have in his library and get as a bar mitzvah present, and just be able to open it up. Rambam said, you know what, let's make it easy. Let's write a systematic code of all of Jewish law. While he was on the subject, he and several other writers started writing books on Jewish philosophy. There were books on Jewish ethics. For the first time, you start seeing disciplines. Everybody understood that they were distillations of the Torah, of the whole Tanakh, of the Talmud, of tradition. But by doing so, something artificial happened. We created categories. Until then, Judaism was religious experience. Nobody thought about writing a treatise on it. You just did it. You had a relationship with God. You didn't have to precisely define belief. You understood. You had a relationship with God. You kept the Torah. You belonged to a community. You understood how things worked without having to define it. In the medieval period, we talked last time just about how Rambam introduced the concept of dogma, but this is happening in every single aspect of Judaism. And this created a very strange divide where there's a big difference even between Rambam's code, the Mishneh Torah, and the Shulchan Aruch, written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, that really became the most important and decisive legal code ever written in Jewish history. Rambam introduces his legal treatise with philosophy. For him, beliefs are central to what our observance is. And so he defined, here are our beliefs and here's what's not belief. Here's ethical development and how to develop a good character, which are just philosophical terms that he got primarily from Aristotelian thought and Greek philosophy in general. And then here are the laws of the morning and of prayer and all the different legal topics that we have in Judaism. The Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, writing in the early 16th century in Sfat, changed the game. He just wrote what we would think of as a dry legal code. There's no philosophy in there. Here are the laws, category by category by category. He was a tremendous mystic and a deeply spiritual personality. But his point of view was, we have disciplines. I'll write about mysticism in these books over here, and I'll write about law in this book over here, and that's it. And they became completely separated. As far as the ancient way of understanding our religion, this is a disaster, actually. Law became a very dry, legalistic component of our faith. And then you had the people who were looking for more. They wanted to feel God's presence. They wanted to have a relationship. They wanted more than just what do we do and what do we not do. And that's where, in the medieval period, you had two replacement systems for the original thing of Jewish experience. Jews were searching for something to hang on to. They wanted more than just the observance. They wanted something where they had a systematic way of understanding God. And the two most important schools in the medieval period were philosophy and Kabbalah, mysticism. It's very important to understand the roots of them, because all of these things affect now tremendously. And that's what today's shiur is really all about. The philosophers were, you know, Rambam was the supreme one, which is why he keeps on getting mentioned. Good morning. There are plenty of source sheets, by the way, so if for some reason you didn't yet get one, we can remedy that, but I just need to know. Rambam was the champion of the whole idea of Jewish philosophy in the medieval sense. He defined philosophy to include what we today call science and what we today call philosophy. For him, physics and metaphysics were part of the same spectrum rather than two totally different worlds. We spent a little bit of time talking about that in the past. So Rambam's point of view was Torah and science and reason never can contradict. That was his basic axiom. And in fact, he defined there are three sources of knowledge. Source number one was, if you could prove something through human reasoning. Again, how one does that, it's hard for us modern folk to relate to that, because we don't have the same idea of, everybody has the same idea of reason and we could prove it. But in the good old days, there was one reason, or so Rambam thought, and he believed that you could prove reason. So anything that is proven, for example, one thing that he considered absolutely proven according to reason is God cannot have a body. Morning, Sam. Welcome. God cannot have a body. It's unreasonable. And therefore, to him, that's something that is proven. Oh, it says time and again, God's arm in the Torah, God's nostrils, God's nose, God's finger, God's hand. Those things cannot be taken literally. And in fact, if you do, in this particular case, you are a heretic. Not only are you wrong, but you are a non-believer. So Rambam took this category of reason very, very, very seriously, and the Torah never can contradict reason, nor can it contradict science. If there is something that we believe that we believe scientifically is proven, Torah never can contradict that. So what happens if there are things in the Torah that sound like they contradict? On the first day, God created a firmament. The literal reading of a firmament, just to make sure that this is clear, is that there's a roof. And there's a hard thing up there in the sky. And why is the sky blue? Because there's water above it. That's literally what a firmament is. The idea is that there's a hard plate, which would make it really rough if you are an astronaut, because you would crash right into that guy and that would be bad. Right, well, that's how it rains. The windows of heaven open, right? So if you take these passages literally, suddenly you have a very unusual conception of the universe that is flat out, as far as we are concerned, wrong. Right? In other words, it can be utterly... Oh, very good. So, one thing you could always bet on with me, I never ever intend a pun. I sometimes make them, but I never intend them. So I don't even need to say no pun intended. But in the meantime, yes.
That's why George is here to help us.
Yeah. Sometimes people see puns where I had no idea that they were coming. But in the meantime, it's very important to understand what Rambam is saying. Rambam is saying God wrote the Torah and gave it to the people of Israel. God made science. And God is the supreme intellect, and therefore everything that he does is reasonable. And therefore, these areas never can contradict. If it looks like it contradicts, that means that we're understanding something wrong. This is a very important interpretive principle, Joe. So you're being a good 21st century thinker. We have a lot of problems with the way that Rambam formulated it, because to Rambam there really was one science, and there was one reason.
It was an Aristotelian world.
Correct, correct. So for Rambam, he believed this was reason and science, and therefore he really thought, here's a system. By the way, long before the 21st century and Joe, there was only one great medieval rabbi who took seriously what Joe said. He was way ahead of his time. Only one. In other words, just about all the rabbis in the world in the 12th century were having a very big fight. When I say very big fight, they all excommunicated each other. They felt that the other side was a true danger to Judaism. So you had the Rambam team who believed that Judaism is reasonable and rational and that it never can contradict science. And therefore, whenever there's anything in the Torah that looks like it contradicts one of these things, you must not take it literally. So when it says God's hand, that means God's power, period. It cannot be taken literally. If it says that Yaakov wrestled with an angel, well, that can't happen according to Rambam. Not in this world. You can never have a metaphysical being show up and get you in the thigh. That cannot happen. It happened in a prophetic vision. And Rambam took this principle to the extreme. He really insisted anything that's for him unreasonable, that's it. Must be reinterpreted. You cannot accept the literal reading of the Torah. That was one camp, the Rambam camp. And many other rabbis thought, oh, thank God, somebody's saying that Judaism is reasonable. We like that. And they thought Rambam was the greatest sheikh on earth.
The other team
thought that Rambam was the most dangerous rabbi in the world. How dare you tell me or any believer what is considered, if the Torah says that there's a roof up there, there's a roof up there. Right? If the Torah talks about the world being less than 6,000 years old, then that's the truth. It doesn't matter what science says. Right? So those rabbis burned Rambam's books, literally. They burned them. There were public book burnings. They considered it heresy. And Rambam was particularly dangerous because everybody agreed the man knows his stuff. In other words, if he was just some banjo third-rate thinker, okay, so you have quacks in every profession, you have quacks in the rabbinate too. Nobody would take him seriously.
By your tongue.
Hmm?
By your tongue.
Yeah.
So nobody said there are things that the human mind can't encompass yet?
Well, the other team, the anti-Rambam team, said, first of all, who says that reason is everything? Uh-huh. And second of all, it doesn't even matter. God wrote the Torah. We believe in whatever the Torah says. And don't tell me that I have to reinterpret it every time you think something different. If it says that Yaakov wrestled an angel, he did. Awake. It really happened. If we took a time machine back, we would see this wrestling match, according to these anti-Rambam people. And so they viewed Rambam as an extremely dangerous threat to Judaism. And they were huge.
Look at the creation of the earth as more than literally 7 days? Or is it just the definition of days that they changed?
Well, you have to remember, in the medieval period, nobody was thinking about 15 billion years. Maybe one or two mystics were, right? But in the meantime, for the most part, that wasn't the threat. One threat that was very serious is that Aristotle believed that the world was not created. He believed the world was always here. So people like Rambam really wrestled with that. And his premise was, it's very interesting, in his Guide to the Perplexed, which is where he really takes these things on, he said, look, if Aristotle could have proven that the world is eternal, based on logic, it doesn't mean empirical proof the way that you and I as scientists might think about it, but at least in Rambam's conception of reality, if Aristotle proved his case, I would have to reinterpret the Torah, which because Rambam believed that the Torah teaches that God created the world, even though that's a debate. But Rambam thought so. So he said, if Aristotle had proven his case, I would reinterpret the Torah to mean that the world is eternal. However, I don't think Aristotle proved his case scientifically, based on 12th century understanding of what that means. And therefore, I continue to believe that the world is created by God. Yes, Shlomo?
How did Rambam handle Para Aduma?
What does he need to handle?
The red heifer. There's no, what's the logic behind it?
Oh, that's a different, in other words, you can agree that, first of all, very important thing, I'm colorblind, so I appreciate this even less than you're going to. The Torah, this is an important thing though, the Torah does not have a word for brown. The Torah does not have a word for brown. So when it talks about the red cow, it's not like a cherry, it's a brown cow. And what makes it unusual is that it has no other hairs of other colors. Most cows, look at any, you know, pass any cows along the road, there are different colors there, right? There's splotches or at least a couple of hairs that are black or white or some other color. What made these brown cows unusual is that they were purely brown. So Rambam, there's nothing irrational about that. That could happen.
Sprinkling.
That's a different question, which we're actually going to get to. Meaning, you're trying to ask, well, why in the world did God legislate that? That's a reason behind a commandment. But there's nothing irrational about having such a cow and having a ceremony about it. The issue is, what in the world is it coming to teach, right? Which is a different layer of problem. Okay, so, yeah, so Alan, hold on.
I'm still not sure in terms of Rambam's point of view. What does he do about miracles? What does he say about revelation? I mean, there are a lot of things that seem to be outside this world's rational.
Very good. The way that he understood, well, first of all, he believed in revelation. He certainly adopted a very Aristotelian and Torah admixture, which again, these rabbis who were busy burning his books thought he was way off the charts in terms of imposing way too much of Greek thought onto Jewish thought. But he most certainly believed in revelation. He didn't understand irrational to mean something that you and I can't see or perceive. There's nothing irrational or unreasonable about revelation. God can do everything, right? If you believe in an all-powerful God, God can choose to reveal himself to people.
He can choose to have an end.
Right, that's what... fine, but Rambam thought he can't make that choice. Same as God cannot choose to make 2 and 2 5. It's impossible, right? In other words, the philosophers discuss these sort of things, right? God cannot make a world where 2 and 2 is 5 according to this way of thinking. That doesn't limit God. It just means 2 and 2 are not 5. And that's it. It's a by definition sort of thing, David.
How do you reconcile what I think is an inherent contradiction between everything being rational and explainable and absolute principles of faith, which is it's the opposite of reason, isn't it?
It's the same question. In other words, he doesn't see things beyond our human rational experience as the only things that are reasonable. He considers revelation to be perfectly reasonable because, again, an all-powerful God can choose to reveal himself. There was nothing weird about that to Rambam at all. There's nothing unreasonable. It's not something that you can prove, right? Rambam wouldn't say, oh, I've scientifically proven that Moshe was a great prophet. He understood that that was a belief, but he didn't think that this belief was irrational, it's super irrational, or something like that. It goes beyond what you and I can see, but it's not irrational. The Torah was not demanding that we believe things that are inconceivable. It's just that, okay, you and I are not prophets, so it's hard for us to understand exactly how that works.
I think you prefaced it at the beginning the best, and that's the hardest part for all of us, because prior to the Enlightenment, philosophy and science and faith all went together, and they were viewed as a complete whole. So this kind of question really didn't come up. It's really a post-Enlightenment issue.
100%.
We're the children of. So
yeah, and we're going to get there.
I'll just say one other thing. At least when you see a Jersey cow, which is black and white, you don't have to worry about being colored.
Oh, Baruch Hashem for Jersey. And in the meantime, so.
Rabbi, what about the oral Torah? Like they discussing this and this. What about the oral Torah with all these explanations of what is written?
Right, so again, God revealed it, and that's it. In other words, Rambam had no problem with the concept of revelation. Jewish faith demands belief in these things, right? In other words, that's the whole point. But there's nothing unreasonable about the idea of God revealing himself. That's all I'm trying to say. It's not, I can't prove it. And it's a belief. But even in Rambam's conception, which was very, very different from ours, in other words, post-Kant, we don't think we can prove beliefs at all. Rambam really thought that he could. It's all going to go back to Joe's question from before, and we're going to get there. So the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, was the one visionary rabbi who was different from all the other rabbis. I'm sure there were others, but really the most important one. You had the Rambam camp and you had the anti-Rambam camp, and they all thought that the other side was horrible, right? The Rambam people thought, how in the world can you believe in the literal reading of the Torah if it's unscientific? That's outrageous. Just like today, how can somebody believe that the world is less than 6,000 years old, right? Or how can you believe that genetically we're all truly related? Talk to any geneticist, they would say that we're crazy to believe that kind of thing, right? So a Rambam living today, without even flinching, he would say the world is whatever science says it is. 15 billion, or the universe is 15 billion years old, if that's what science shows. Keeping in mind that science changes, in other words, we have a lot more maturity about how seriously we take science, but Rambam would never deny the findings of science. And oh, if the world, if the Torah gives the impression that the world is 6,000 years old, we need to take that as allegorical, or that a day doesn't really mean 24 hours, or that's how Rambam would deal with things like that. If there was evolution, great. And Rambam would try to show even how the Torah teaches evolution, perhaps. You might not have seen it before somebody came up with the idea of evolution. And if somebody refutes evolution one day and comes up with a better theory, funny enough, you'll suddenly find that in the Torah. And by the way, there are plenty of books written today in this spirit, right? Where people try to reconcile 21st century science as we know it with the Torah. Jews and Christians are very involved in this business. There are all kinds of books that are published where they try to reconcile contemporary scientific findings. In other words, they don't do it with philosophy anymore, because there's certainly not one philosophy like there might have been in the 12th century. So that's one camp. There's a second camp, the anti-Rambam camp, that would just say these books are heretical. How dare anybody tamper with the literal meaning of the Torah? So you'll have Christian fundamentalists in this camp, certain forms of orthodoxy also, of Judaism, where people say that everything in the Torah must be taken in its fully literal form. Kuzari in the 12th century was so ahead of his time, Rabbi Yehuda Alevi in Spain. He studied philosophy. He knew philosophy from within. He wasn't just shooting it down as an outsider who said, I don't know what this is, but it's foreign. He knew it very well. He said what Joe said, but he said it in the 12th century, which, you know, to us, yeah. We would all immediately say, there's no one philosophy, or science changes. Kuzari said, it's silly to try to reconcile the Torah with any one philosophical system. Who says there's only one? Everybody else, all these medieval philosophers are treating there's one reason and one philosophy. Kuzari said, what are you talking about? Even in the 12th century, there were different schools. So how do we know which one's right?
Didn't they talk about truth?
Everybody talks about truth. Everybody talks about truth, but what the Kuzari's point is that Judaism never makes us believe in anything that's irrational. Thank God. But you can't use reason alone to prove religion. He was saying this in the 12th century, long before Kant. And bless him, because his vision, he was kind of such an outsider in this debate in the 12th century, because everybody else was either a diehard philosopher and spending all his time trying to reconcile Torah and science as they understood it, or burning those books because they said Torah cannot be reconciled with anything. Torah is a unique document given to us by God, and we simply don't care what scientific findings or what some philosopher thinks. We believe in the Torah, period. So let's go over to Shlomo and his red cow. One of the most impressive debates that continues to this day also is, should we care about why God commanded the red cow or not?
What do you mean by care?
I'll tell you. Rambam believed very emphatically that the entire Torah must make sense to people. It must. God is supremely rational. God made us as rational beings, even though sometimes when I look at people, I'm not sure. But at least in principle, we all could be rational. And therefore, God would never give us something that we could not, if we tried very hard, that we could not understand. God is too reasonable. And therefore, as far as he is concerned, in source number one, he was outraged at those Jews who said, the reason why I don't eat a ham and cheese sandwich, not that that's any worse than just eating a ham sandwich, by the way, but you know, both of them are bad, is because God said so. There cannot be, I keep all the mitzvot because God commanded them. I don't need to know why. Red cow, fine. It's weird to me also, I don't know what it means. But God commanded it, so in the temple times when there was ritual purity and impurity that affected your ability to access the temple, well, you needed to get sprinkled if you came into contact with a human corpse. Okay, that's the way God wants it. I'm just going to do it because that's how I serve my God. A lot of Jews felt that that was the best way to serve God. Rambam didn't care for that at all. And so in source number one, he says, it's in the Guide to the Perplexed, there is a group of human beings who consider it a grievous thing that causes should be given for any law. Meaning some Jews sincerely believe that it's wrong to even ask, why did God command this? So Shlomo, that group doesn't like you. You asked, right? What would please them most is that the intellect would not find a meaning for the commandments and prohibitions. In other words, they would be happiest to say, why do I serve God? Because God told me to serve him. Doesn't matter if it's reasonable or not to me. What compels them to feel thus is a sickness, In this regard, Rambam reveals his bias on the subject. He says, these guys are sickos. What's wrong with these people? That they find in their souls a sickness to which they are unable to give utterance and of which they cannot furnish a satisfactory account. What's wrong with these people, says Rambam? People who think that serving God best is just by blindly serving God is absolutely, as far as Rambam is concerned, absolutely wrong. And it's sick. That's not good religion, he says, right? For they think that if those laws were useful in this existence and had been given to us for this or that reason, it would be as if they derived from the reflection and the understanding of some intelligent being. If, however, there is a thing for which the intellect could not find any meaning at all, and that does not lead to something useful, it undoubtedly derives from God, for the reflection of man would not lead to such a thing. Some Jews really like the idea of what we would think of as non-rational commandments. I won't call them irrational, but non-rational. There's no way to explain why did God prohibit cooking meat and milk together. There's no way to explain what's up with the red cow ritual. There are many laws that are very, very hard to just say, oh yeah, it says thou shalt not steal. Okay, I get it, right? I can. Lots of these laws you and I can figure out. You didn't even need the Torah. You might need the Torah to precisely define certain laws. Okay, but that's very different from saying, what is he talking about, right? When it comes to many of the laws, we look at the Torah and are baffled. What's God doing it? Well, some Jews like those laws better, because that's what makes it religion. You know, to be rational, we could all be good human beings, and I wish everybody would be a good human being. But you don't need to be Jewish. There's nothing covenantal about not stealing in this view. Well, Rambam says that that's sick. Rambam says that the Torah is all meant to improve our souls and our characters, and all the nations of the world should see Jews observing the Torah and say, what a beautiful religion. Rambam goes on and on about this, and every law, according to him, is rational. And if you don't understand it, it's because we lack information. So for example, on the cooking meat and milk together, he assumed that there must have been some pagan ritual involving seething a kid, meaning a goat kid, in its mother's milk. So even if we don't know of that ritual, there must have been a ritual in the ancient world, and so the Torah wanted to outlaw all pagan practices because paganism also equals immorality. And so the Torah wanted us to be moral, to believe in one supreme God, and to keep God's laws which are supremely moral. Rambam says that the whole Torah reflects that, no exceptions. And so Rambam believed that we have to search for the reasons. Yeah.
The Jewish uniform, you might say, because regular life, governments have uniforms for soldiers, for policemen, so forth. Why does he have to wear a blue suit?
Right. But it's more than just a uniform. It's that this is our way of serving God. If God says don't cook meat and milk together, and I don't, I'm really serving God. If God says don't steal, and I don't steal. You don't need to do that to serve God. In other words, it defines you. I think you're right. Yeah, Benjamin.
Does pagan practices exist today on a level that, as Jews, we have to behave to counter that pagan?
What about the worship of money?
In other words, when does this behavior that we're doing to specifically to counteract paganism no longer is necessary? Paganism does not exist.
Oh yeah.
I wish you were right.
Fortunately, we don't have to go out there and convert the whole world. That's not part of our, not actively anyway. We have to set a model for the world. That's our job. So Rambam wasn't interested in people who bow down to idols somewhere in India. He cares about what are we doing to be a model nation so that eventually those people who are bowing to idols will learn that's not the way to fly. Right? In other words, we're not a missionary religion. Which again is one of the things that I'm very grateful for so many reasons. In source number two, there is not a single commandment, this is still Rambam, there's not a single commandment that does not have a reason, although most of the reasons are beyond the comprehension of the minds of the ordinary person. It goes back to Shlomo's point. Rambam insists every mitzvah has a reason, even if we open up the Torah and we can't necessarily discern those reasons. But the bottom line is, it goes back to Rambam's core principle, 100% of the laws are to make us better people, and 100% of the laws are to get us away from paganism and toward pure God worship, because pure God worship in the Torah makes us better people. Okay, yeah, David?
What is the basis for making a grand pronouncement like that? There's not a single commandment that does not have a reason, although none of us know what the reasons are either.
Well, the regular people don't know. He knows. Rambam's not a regular person. Rambam, in his Guide to the Perplexed, spends a lot of time telling us his core principles for how the whole Torah is organized, and he believes that these are true. Even though it's not evident. In other words, if you and I read the Torah together, we won't see the reasons in the Torah.
But without any support for his argument, why should one accept it at face value?
It's a philosophy. You can't prove his point. I happen to like his point very much. I think that a proper observance of the Torah does yield exceptionally moral people, if you do it right.
Why should you believe that God isn't reasonable? God is reasonable. He'll give us reasonable commandments.
The trick to philosophy is the philosopher produces a thesis. He's given one. You're just given that. And the rest of the time is spending trying to justify what you've said. But you're given the right to say that. All philosophy is then about justifying.
Right. So again, Rambam can't prove his point in scientific terms to you, David, or to anybody else. But he is absolutely convinced that God, being the supreme reasonable being, would give something that's supremely reasonable to us.
But he may be convinced, but what in his pronouncement convinces me, or is supposed to convince me?
Well, he's arguing for the goodness of the cause, meaning since God is good and God gave us the Torah, therefore the Torah is good. You can accept or not accept that.
No.
Right? I'm not trying to sell his point of view. I'm trying to explain it. The Khuzari, who is Rambam's antagonist from within the world of philosophy, thought just the opposite. In source number 3, he writes...
That's the opposite, the main leader.
He disagreed with Rambam.
The leader of the opposite position.
Yeah, he wouldn't burn Rambam's books.
Oh.
He liked philosophy too. He just thought that the Jewish philosophers abused, they gave too much weight to philosophy. In other words, what Job was saying as a matter of fact point that we would all agree in the 21st century was not at all clear in the 12th century. The Khuzari was way ahead of his time. So he argues in source number 3, I say it is God's Torah. He who innocently accepts it without scrutiny or argument is better off than he who investigates and analyzes. It's better not to be a philosopher. It's better to have pure faith and do the Torah because that's what God wants.
Very nice.
Then he says, he, however, who steps down from the highest level to scrutiny. Let's say the bug bites you and you ask, why did God command this? Mm-hmm. That's a problem. You're already not the ideal. The ideal is you do it because God said so. But let's say the bug bites you and you say, well, what's the point? Now, does well to seek the reasons for these matters that are founded upon divine wisdom instead of abandoning them to evil opinions and doubts which lead man to perdition. Once the bug bites you and you ask, why did God command it? Well, then you have to become a philosopher.
What opinion did he have on Hanukkah?
Huh?
On Hanukkah. Because it wasn't in the Torah. And when one looks into the Talmud, one sees probably what happened was that the Maccabees...
Fine, okay, that's a... Yeah.
And therefore the 8 days come from that, not from this miracle.
Fine. All good things, but that's beyond this particular debate. I'm interested in the framework of what's the ideal Jew, because that's what they're fighting over here. Rambam says the ideal Jew is the Jewish philosopher. You always ask, why did God? And then you spend your whole life trying to figure that out. Right? And Rambam is utterly convinced, going back to David's question, utterly convinced that since God is supremely good and supremely reasonable, the Torah must be those things, and therefore the whole Torah is meant to refine us. Khuzari doesn't disagree. He also thinks the Torah refines us. But he says it's better not even to ask. Trust that God knows what he's doing and gave us something good, and just do what he says. That's what he thinks is the ideal. If you start asking, why did God do that, now you have to become a philosopher. In other words, you can't just be left with a why question. But he thinks that that's sub-ideal. Ideal is not even to ask the question. Yeah, Rita?
Then you have much bigger questions besides why the bug bite me. Why were there crusades? Why was there Holocaust?
That's a different issue, and not an unimportant one, by the
right.
way. And those are different, and by the way, certain rabbis were upset with Rambam for asking not those particular examples, but Rambam definitely tried to deal with the problem of when bad things happen to good people.
Right.
And he, of course, could not provide a good answer because there's no way you're going to come up with a good answer for that one. And so that led to all kinds of fights about, is it better just not to ask the question? But of course, people have been asking this question for thousands of years. That's not a medieval or modern problem. That's ancient, that particular problem. So while Rambam was busy trying to purify Judaism and make it utterly reasonable, and therefore Rambam, among other things, battled tooth and nail against all superstitions. One of the sickest and saddest things that you will ever find if you go to Tzfat is not just all the magical charms you can get and all, it's such a racket, all these holy waters and holy beads and holy ribbons and string, you name it, it's holy and it's for sale, right? drives me up a wall. But the saddest part of all of those shops in Sfat, actually, is that on many of them, they say, here is a charm that Rambam specifically liked.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, if Rambam would read one of these things and say that his name is on it, he would turn in his grave so many times he'd never be able to stop spinning, poor fellow. Like, Rambam's whole life was dedicated to fighting this type of, he said, this isn't religion, and it's certainly not our religion. Judaism is reasonable, and Rambam, and he codifies these things into laws, the laws of idolatry, of course, which is where it belongs. In source number 4, if one whispers an incantation on a wound and recites a verse from the Torah, or recites a verse over a child to alleviate its fright, in other words, let's say you read biblical verses hoping to magically cure somebody, or places a Torah scroll or tefillin on a child to enable it to sleep, not only are such people in the category of sorcerers and soothsayers, but they are included among those who deny the Torah. I'm sure that you get these emails too. I get these emails all the time, or maybe I'm on different lists, and I get these emails from friends even. Like, you know, please read this passage in the Torah today and you'll be guaranteed a better income.
Yeah.
I wish it were that easy. I wish...
Huh? That's what they do. You said the Torah makes better people.
Right.
Well, how are they? Well,
this is very anti. Rambam says that such a person is an idolater. And I always say, can you please stop using the Torah as an idolatrous charm? The Torah is a God-given document that guides our lives. And you're turning it into a little magic trick to help me get a raise. Like, that's not the way it's supposed to be. And I get very upset about these just based on Rambam's diehard opposition to the use of even religious, forgetting about like the strings that you get at the kotel, right, and all that stuff. I'm talking about even use of really sacred objects, such as the Torah or tefillin or mezuzot, and using them as magical objects. Rambam says that this is idolatry. He's very emphatic about trying to root out superstition. And so again, the Rambam supporters loved that and became much less superstitious. That is a good thing. What happened as a counter reaction was the increase in Kabbalah, which happened exactly in the 12th and 13th century. Many scholars claim that Kabbalah, quote unquote, came out of the closet. In other words, there was always mysticism. It wasn't invented in the 12th and 13th century, but it was always small circles of sages and little circles of students. It wasn't out there. It became a lot more public, and in part, at least according to many historians of Judaism, came out of the closet as a counter-reaction to Rambam's trying to purge superstition from the religion. They said, oh yeah, watch this, we're going to make it even more superstitious and more available to everybody. That was a big thing that happened in the 12th century, and this led to, again, significant battles, ideological battles between different schools. The Zohar, you know, scholars debate exactly its origins, but it seems to have come primarily out of the 13th century Spain from somebody named Rabbi Moshe de Leon. And for the first time it was published. Now, it wasn't all invented, meaning some teachings, I'm sure, are much older than that, that were just oral and always kept in closed circles. But for the first time, there was this massive corpus of Kabbalah literature that you could buy. And once the printing press came, and once you had Kabbalah centers, and all of a sudden, you know, you can get all this stuff in translation online, right? You can get all of these things. It's incredibly readily available. The original text, as well as the incredibly dumbed down versions, which are almost pure superstition in many cases, right? So Rambam, again, he was trying so hard to root that out, and we can all speak with certainty some 800-900 years later, he utterly failed. Utterly failed. His project to make Judaism a purely rational religion worked for many of us, but it blew up in his face for many others of us, where some people specifically wanted the supra-rational or irrational, depending on what it was, and they wanted mysticism. They wanted to be able to manipulate God. That's one of the cool things about mysticism. You can do all kinds of great stuff to manipulate God. Rambam says that's idolatry. You can't manipulate God. Our prayers don't make God do things, right? But if you think that your prayers do make God do things, or that you think that keeping Shabbat in a certain way can make God do things, or wearing a little ribbon around your wrist can make God do things, well, that's a lot of power that you got, which borders very dangerously on just what every pagan system did, which was control of the gods. God always has a choice.
That's what I mean.
But Kabbalah, at least on certain systems of Kabbalah, you really think that you can achieve results. So let's talk about, just briefly, the pros and the cons to each system, the philosopher's system and the Kabbalah system, and how this played out in history, very briefly. The religious philosophers believe that the way you get closest to God is through the relentless pursuit of truth. That's what it's all about. through ideas, through science, through understanding that there's some cosmic whole, because God revealed the Torah and gave us science and gave us reason, and we have to unify them. That's the good news of philosophy. It roots out superstition. There's no, God is supremely above all of us. There's no manipulation of God. That's not what it's all about. Religion is trying to understand God's will, to understand the mitzvot, to do them, and to have a purely unified system. That's what the philosophers were trying to do. The Kabbalists said, you philosophers are evil because you're depending too much on human reason. We don't know everything. It goes back to Rita's point. The Kabbalists said, we need to depend on tradition. Kabbalah means tradition. It's not philosophy. Philosophy means you're trying to love knowledge. You're trying to pursue the truth based on your own intellect. Kabbalah says, no, we need a teacher. We need a holy man. We need a received tradition, and there is one truth, and we're trying to get it from the holy man. So on the one hand, there's something very humble about Kabbalah that philosophy risks losing. Kabbalah says we have to defer. We can't totally rely on our mind. There's something very humble and religious about the Kabbalistic premise. That's the upside. The downside is it completely roots out critical thinking. It roots out questioning, because after all, if the master says something, the master is, that's the truth. That's the source of my truth. It becomes a very authoritarian system where the holy man has all the power. Now again, if the holy man actually is holy, things could be worse. That's actually good. The problem, of course, in our day and age is when you have some of these holy men who are utterly corrupt and they're completely beyond rebuke. And that causes an awful lot of harm and devastation in many different communities. But there's another big difference. And that is that a philosopher's way of thinking about it is you have to take an active role in the world. You have to interact with other people. The whole idea of finding, David Hartman said this very, very well. David Hartman's point about Rambam's saying that we need to interpret the commandments so that they make sense, it's because how do you talk to somebody who doesn't believe in what we believe in? The Torah has to have a universal message. If I can tell you that the whole Torah is meant to refine our character and make us super moral and root out idolatry and bring in service of God, which makes me a better person and builds a better community, you don't need to be a believing Jew to get that. Everybody says, wow, that's terrific. What a wise system. Now let's see it work. Right? But in other words, the concept makes sense. If I just say, well, I'm not cooking meat and milk together because God says so. Well, let's say somebody says, well, God didn't say it to me. So why do I care what you do? Okay, so very nice. The non-rational system, the Kuzari's message, it becomes an insular message. It's only good for fellow believers. But there's no message to the outside world anymore. You can't even try to translate it for the outside world. Philosophy creates an interaction with the world. If you want to convert all of Jewish teaching into something that's a world religion, you need to be able to speak to people of the world who don't share our beliefs. That includes Jews who don't share our beliefs, that includes non-Jews who don't share our beliefs, everybody. We're not just a community of believers, we have beliefs that we think are valuable. The non-philosopher position is we just have to be good observant Jews and live in our own isolated communities. It doesn't matter really what anybody else thinks. We're doing it to serve God, and if somebody else doesn't serve God, that is their problem. And this led to one of my favorite books of my father is Voices in Exile. I think it's fabulous. If you haven't read it, or if you haven't read it recently, read it. It's really, I think it's really one of the best books out there, not just for dealing with some of the great Sephardic thinkers post-expulsion from Spain, where most of Jewish education has completely dropped the ball. Like, everybody knows medieval Spain is great, but somehow what Sephardic communities did for the last 500 years is almost off the radar in most Jewish educational systems, and Voices in Exile is one major step toward trying to revive it. But it's not just history. It's history of ideas. And one of my favorite chapters in this book is his little saga between, it's a big saga, between Rabbi Eliezer, two rabbis in Sarajevo, which became Yugoslavia. One was named Rabbi Eliezer Papo, and one was Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai. They knew each other. They interacted with each other. Rabbi Alkalai was a little bit younger. Rabbi Eliezer Papo was part of the mystical inward Judaism that became very dominant after the destruction of the Second Temple already. Once Jews felt that they were powerless in the world, there's no point in being an activist. Our best thing that we can do is build up strong communities, keep the Torah, live in isolation, because we have no hope out there. There was a sense of despair after the destruction of the Second Temple that created a very passive outlook on the world. Rabbi Papo believed, quite sincerely, if you have a rotten marriage, thank God for that, because you're going to have such a great share in heaven. Don't go to a marriage counselor. Don't don't end the marriage. Just hang in there, suffer all you want, but boy, oh boy, you'll get great heaven. Tell that to the poor spouses who are utterly miserable during their lifetime. But he really believed that. And all of his outlook revolved around a very passive acceptance of fate. And by the way, this affected his younger colleague, Rabbi Alkalai. He was one of the very first Zionists. He was a true religious Zionist. Rabbi Alkalai said, why in the world, if Jews are being persecuted, what were most rabbis saying? There were blood libels in 1840 in the island of Rhodes and Damascus. So the rabbi of the island of Rhodes, who was personally imprisoned and later on came out, his first sermon back in synagogue after he was personally tortured and imprisoned, this is in 1840, he said, it's because of our sins. He didn't say, why are we letting the dominant culture persecute us like this with these horrible lies? He didn't talk about activism. He just said, it's because of our sins. We need to pray better. We need to come to synagogue more often. We need to keep Shabbat better. Whatever he said, it's because of us. Rabbi Alkalai said, what is our problem? We're getting persecuted. Let's do something about it. Let's build communal organizations. Let's work with politicians. Let's create a way of protecting ourselves against these terrible lies. Let's speak up. That was unheard of. He was so ahead of his time, and he said, we need to create a Jewish state. He was one of the very first, he was friends, by the way, with Herzl's grandfather. But he was a religious figure. He wasn't a secularist. He was a religious figure who said, we need to create a Jewish state. And he went around the Jewish world saying, we have to build a homeland. We have to go back to Israel, build a religious community. He didn't use the term Zionism, but that's what he was talking about. And most rabbis thought he was crazy. They said, we're waiting for the Mashiach. We're not going to actively do anything. We're just waiting. When God tells us it's time to come back and the Messiah comes, we'll go back. That's what most of the religious world thought. Passive acceptance of fate, inward turning, trying to build up a religious community insular. They just lost sight of the activism part of Judaism. Rabbi Alkalai was so ahead of his time, but the rabbis all laughed at him. You know, they almost entirely ignored him, which is why, by the way, when Rabbi Alkalai's friend, grandson, Theodor Herzl, founded Zionism, nearly all of its support came from non-Orthodox Jews, right? Zionism was primarily either a non-religious or an anti, I shouldn't say non-religious, it was very religious, but not traditional Judaism religious, right? These were passionate, inspired people. I don't want to say that David Ben-Gurion was not religious. He was an extremely religious man, but not in the traditional Jewish way. Yeah?
But Rabbi, in the Ashkenazic prayers, every time, every fast day, it all says, because we sinned, we're fasting. Because we sinned,
yeah.
We lost our land. Because we sinned, and so on.
Everywhere. We say this all the time. This is a very ancient post-Second Temple destruction idea. It really is rooted in our blood. So what Rabbi Alkalai said, okay, fine, so we sin, let's get better, but we also have to do things. In other words, we can't just take our fate as passive. By the way, an extreme example more recently, going back to Rita's question, after the Holocaust, okay, some very prominent rabbis, very important ones, one got up there and said, it's because Jews are Zionists, it's because of our sins, okay? Mm-hmm. That was the Satmar Rebbe.
Right?
So the Satmar philosophy was Zionism is evil, and he blamed the entire Holocaust on Zionists. Okay?
Right? Do most of them.
Yeah, that was the ideology. Rabbi Eliezer Shach, one of the heads of the so-called Haredi world, got up there and said it's because too many Jews have assimilated. It's the Jews' fault. Rabbi Soloveitchik got up there in 1956 and he said it's an outrage to say why God allowed a Holocaust. Like, how do you speak like that? He was so emphatically against. I suppose I can just say my sympathies are with this point of view. How dare anybody say why God does something? Rabbi Soloveitchik said the Jewish position is not to say God did this because of that. We don't know why God does things. He said our job when a catastrophe occurs, obviously this is bigger than your standard catastrophe, this is larger than life in every sense. When a catastrophe occurs, our job is to ask ourselves, what should we do now? Not why did God. If you ask why did God, you're either going to arrogantly say why God did something and you don't know, and typically speaking it's truly offensive, right? Or you'll just be baffled and then get upset, right? It doesn't lead to any productive discourse when you ask, why did God, right? But when you say, what can we do? He said, well, that speech, by the way, was in the context of, we need to build the land of Israel. He said, in other words, we have an obligation now. We have an opportunity. He was speaking in 1956, 8 years after the founding of the state and only 11 years after the Holocaust ended, saying we have a historic opportunity to build the Jewish homeland. We must do that. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who took strong issue with those rabbis, great rabbis, But rabbis who believed that they understood, it was because of our sins. What you pick a sin. Yeah, Rebecca?
Would it be fair to say that the one instance in which, or maybe it's that the gentleman was referring to, where you say because of our sins we were kicked out of the land, there is actually explicit statement of that particular catastrophe, but not the ones, you know, that happened?
You're right, and that makes me feel a little bit better also. But there's also no question, if you just look at our Jewish literature, from time immemorial, biblical, Talmudic, rabbinic, all the way down, that train of thought is not a minority train of thought. Rabbi Soloveitchik is actually stepping out of the box by saying, we're not in, in other words, he would say what you just said.
No, I was agreeing with you. I was saying that the only time that we have a specific reference to something, a bad thing happening because of something else is really when, in the Torah, it says if you don't follow these rules in the land's going to spit you out. But
right.
Since that time, we don't have any kind of explanation.
We certainly. Well, the way that we would say it is even stronger, just agreeing with your point, that we don't have prophets telling us why God did things. If you're not a prophet, we cannot know. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik's position as well. That's what you're saying. I agree, 100%, and even more if there were more percents than that.
Yeah, but saying, like on the fast days and things like that,
yeah.
Would we be maybe referring to the time where there actually is an explanation of that sort?
You're
not to like, oh, this past year, all the bad things that happened, or the
you're right, but all I'm saying is that later rabbis who were not prophets, who still made such proclamations, are not, that's not a sparse thing. There are plenty and plenty of rabbinic statements in an age where there is no prophecy, and God isn't saying, this is why this is happening. He simply applied the Torah's principles and said, it's because of our sins. It's not an unreasonable application. And so the Rabbi Soloveitchik said, that doesn't get us anywhere. In other words, we have to, and so Rabbi Alkalai was way ahead of his time, but you have to understand how ahead of his time he was, that people thought he was crazy to say that we need to build a homeland and that we should have active fight anti-Semitism and work with governments and try very hard to prevent the problem. By the way, we've discovered since Rabbi Alkalai, it's a hard thing to do. That doesn't mean that we should give up. In other words, the activist groups that try very hard to protect us and to, you know, deflate all these horrible libels that continue to happen all the time, we have an obligation as a community to do that. That was Rabbi Alkalai's position. Yeah, Lucien?
After the expulsion from Spain, there were a lot of people who went to the Holy Land.
There were groups, but not the majority, right? I mean, there were groups that mystics in particular, Rabbi Yosef Karo was part of that circle.
Yeah, there was a big movement to go
big,
back.
Big, but again, not international. I mean, most Jews remained in the diaspora. There were small enclaves in Sfad, in Yerushalayim, in Tveria. Different groups did go over there, but it was always a very tiny percentage of Jews, yeah. Rambam was far closer to what Rebecca said in terms of not trying to say this is why God did things.
Well,
that's the same. No, the rationale means this. I'm trying to explain it, right? We're saying the same thing. Rambam wasn't in the business of trying to say this is why God does things. Yeah, no, I think it's good. So I completely agree with you. Rambam wasn't like this. Okay, now one last major point for the day. Rabbi Yuval Sherlo, who's a Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, I think he's one of the more thoughtful people out there in the world today. He's really a very interesting figure.
What's his name?
Yuval Sherlo. He's an Israeli man, and he's really very, very, very good. He wrote it's part of the For Further Study. He wrote an enormous book on the Song of Songs in 2003, and it's about 500 pages long in Hebrew. I finally read it back in 2008, loved it, wrote a review of it. You can read the review, which is a much shorter thing. It's in some of my collections of essays. Rabbi Sherlo said, very correctly, that after this philosophy and Kabbalah, the two great medieval systems that competed for space in Jewish thought for so long, we're finally now in the 21st century getting over back to what it was in the biblical period, which is, we don't systematize thought. It all goes back to Joe's point from the very, very beginning of today's Shiur. We realize that we can't create one coherent system of Jewish thought that is Judaism in the way that everybody in the 12th century, except for the Khuzari, thought was possible. Now we're much more interested in authentic religious experience. right? In other words, we've really gone back to the biblical and Talmudic way of dealing with God and religion, which is observance is still at the heart, but so many more synagogues like to sing. People want to feel authentic experience. That's actually a closer resemblance to what it used to be in the good old days, before all these medieval debates. And I thought that was an incredibly wise thing. One of the more important points, it goes back to something that George said before. When Immanuel Kant demonstrated that you cannot prove tenets of faith, he was the one who really, the critique of pure reason, in the 18th century, Kant. So when Kant made that case, which had enormous influence on all thinkers of all different backgrounds, some people thought, if you can't prove religion, let's stop being religious. Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was a great religious philosopher and who knew Kant from the inside, said, no, it's just the opposite. Thank God Kant came along. Because for centuries, we've been breaking our heads trying to reconcile Torah and faith with science. And Kant is saying we can stop doing that now. Let's keep the Torah. So going back to the question, just to give you a for example, and then with one wrap-up point, and that'll be it for today. What do you do when the Torah is talking about God creating the world in 6 days and science telling you that it's 15 billion years old? So what are the three options? The three options are the Neo-Rambam system, which would say, let's try to reconcile the literal reading of the Torah with today's science and show why the Torah, it's not really a day, it's not 24 hours, try to reconcile Torah and science. That's one approach. The other approach is to say, well, if it says that God created the world in 6 days, that's it. That's however many hours that ends up being, 144 or so. 144 hours, that's the end. And if you think otherwise, you're a heretic, you're a non-believer. And we're going to burn your books if you say that the world is older than that. Those are the modern day precursors to the Rambam and anti-Rambam camp. What would the Khuzari camp say? The Torah is not a science book. The Torah is coming to teach eternal truths. You don't have to reconcile it with today's science and then worry that tomorrow's science will be different. The Torah is trying to teach us how to live. It's not giving you scientific axioms. It's not a biology or physics textbook. Once you hear that, you realize, yeah, of course. That's the way to fly. In other words, that we can accept everything that science teaches. It doesn't matter. It doesn't threaten faith at all. But we shouldn't think that the Torah is teaching you today's science. It never was and never will be. It wasn't teaching ancient science either.
It does have to be truth.
It has to be truth. But it doesn't have to be scientifically true in that sense. In other words, if the Torah is trying to teach basic elements of how God relates to the world and humanity and how we're supposed to relate to God, that's of supreme importance. If the theory of evolution isn't found in Genesis chapter 1, that's okay. That's what's important. The Torah doesn't contradict any of truth. But the Torah never makes us believe something that's untrue or unreasonable. But you don't have to find today's science in the pages of the Torah. That's the difference. So there again, if you want to believe that what's reasonable, then you would say, if you want to reconcile, you could say it's periods of time. If you don't, you could just say God is trying to teach about creation and the importance of Shabbat. Right? In other words, why is Shabbat so important? Shabbat bonds us with God as the Creator God. It's an amazing thing, right? Who cares about how old the cosmos really is? What matters is Shabbat is really central to our covenant with God. The last point is that Rabbi Cook, and followed by Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, realized that the core problem in the Orthodox community today is the separation of Judaism into disciplines. Some people keep the laws and they've lost this life force that we've been talking about. They've lost the philosophy, they've lost the experience, they've lost the Kabbalah. They were both great mystics who were both also very reasonable people. They were not irrational mystics. They understood that religious experience comes with observance, comes with the life force of Judaism. It comes as one organic package. So Rav Kook and Rav Halevi both argued very emphatically the way to restore the life force of Judaism and make it appealing to everybody is by showing that observance and spirituality they're the same. You don't have a dry legal code and then singing and two different things. No, they all go hand in hand. And so they wrote extensively. That's the vision that we're trying to promote. One that is completely reasonable, that's spiritually uplifting, but that where all parts of Judaism just go back to one organic whole. Not as a systematic thought, but as religious experience. Next week is Veterans Day, so we're actually not meeting next week. Just be aware of that.
Bank isn't open.
Bank is closed.
Not our fault, it's the bank's fault. But the